Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. Now everyone's doing it. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, the Grenfell Tower atrocity. Not the tragedy, the atrocity. What have we learned? No prosecutions, and flammable cladding is still on scores of houses and flats across the country. And then, the wider housing crisis. What's behind it and how to fix it? With BCFM's housing expert, Roma Widger. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show.
My name is Joe Delaney. I was a resident of Barrandon Walk, which is on the Lancaster West Estate, part of which was Grenfell Tower. I was evacuated on the night of the fire, and I'm still in temporary accommodation two and a bit years later.
Why is that? Have you been offered somewhere that's been not suitable? I mean, we would like to think that all of those have been offered decent accommodation nearby, which is equivalent at least to where they were before.
Well, you see, that's what the problem is. It's the equivalency issue. I mean, the flat I'm in, I didn't even look at this place before they offered it to me. I'd had a year in a hotel by that point. I moved into it in June last year. I'd had a year in a hotel by that point, and frankly, I was fed up with hotels. I mean, the staff at the Novotel Hammersmith were lovely, but it just wasn't a home, and it was very difficult with me, for me and sort of doing anything while I was in a hotel, especially with pets. So they offered it to me. I accepted it without even seeing the place. I was saying, no, I'm going to go for that one. Thank you. I was promised a like-for-like tenancy. And then as time has gone on and I've been more settled, what they've been doing is slowly saying to me, oh, by the way, we can't give you this particular guarantee. So the first thing was right to buy. So I was like, okay, I'll waive that. Then the second thing was matching the rent of Lancaster West Estate, because that's what we were promised. I was like, okay, I can waive that. And now they're saying I won't have a secure tenancy. So I even agreed to that. I said, all right, I will acquiesce to that one. And now they're saying that I can't have a perpetual tenancy, which is what I had before.
Okay, well, this sounds appalling, but who is they?
Kensington and Chelsea Council.
Now, Kensington and Chelsea Council were supposed to be responsible for Grenfell Tower. Obviously, they weren't being responsible. So this really is coming back to the same mismanagement.
Oh, it is, absolutely. I mean, what they did in the immediate aftermath of the fire was they shut down their housing register. And anyone who was on the housing register, they said, sorry, we can't deal with your cases at the moment. We're prioritising Grenfell. Now, that makes no logical sense whatsoever, because let's say they had a property that wasn't suitable for anyone who was there. Let's say it was a one-bedroom place and all they had left were families. Well, why still keep your common housing register closed? And they knew damn well what they were doing. They were trying to build an us and them type thing. And it's the narrative they've constantly filled. You know, if someone says something erroneous about them online on Facebook or on Twitter or on something, they're immediately out correcting the record. But they're quite happy for people to call to blame residents of Grenfell or residents of Lancaster West who were evacuated.
What you're suggesting here is that Kensington and Chelsea Council are seeing this as a kind of image management problem rather than a housing problem. Issue.
They are. I mean, you can check some of the media I did in the immediate aftermath of the fire. That was my phrase. I said, look, Kensington and Chelsea Council are and I don't call them the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea. They don't deserve that title anymore. I only wish that, you know, Buckingham Palace would see it the same way. But yeah, KNC Council do see it that way. I said they're managing a PR disaster. We're living in a humanitarian disaster that they created, and they don't care. All they were interested in is what virtue signaling acts could they undertake that made them look good, and that's what they've been doing.
What about the stay put policy? That's come in for a lot of criticism that the firefighters that turned up on the scene, I mean, one would have thought that anyone managing that fire would see fairly quickly as the fire spread up the building, around the building, enveloped the building.
I mean, you can check my statement, which is on the Grenfell Inquiry website. And as one of the articles of evidence I submitted was my 999 call. Because I had an app on my phone that recorded calls any received or made calls. It recorded them. So I recorded the 999 call. I made the call at 1:27, I think it was. I got through at 1:34 or 1:35 because the 999 service was so overwhelmed with calls. And I declared it a major incident at that point. So, I mean, the Met Police and I both declared it at that point. I could see it as an amateur. I've done emergency planning work in the past, and I could see that by 1:30, it's in my statement, black and white, by 1:30, I knew people were going to die. But I didn't want to say that in front of people, so I went and quietly rang 999, and I was like, you need to deploy everything. This is a serious incident. This is, we need to treat it as such. We need a response of all responders. All responders need to be here now dealing with this. And, you know, because then the major incident protocols are meant to kick in. And I know how to do that because I've done work on the Notting Hill Carnival in the past. And, we learned how to do that when I was at Brent. And the 999 staff, and this is in Morbick's report, the 999 staff just were not taking things seriously at the time.
I mean, one would have thought that they would be overwhelmed with calls. They would realise something very serious was happening.
Well, they were. They were overwhelmed with calls, but still they just weren't taking people seriously. And what I find most the most shocking element of that evidence was the fact that even people who were ringing them from inside the tower, for example, and saying, I'm on floor 21 or 22 and there's smoke on my floor and I can't get outside. Even those people, they weren't taking seriously. And that was what took. That was one of the reasons that it took so long for the disaster to be scaled up. I mean, the guy who was there initially, Michael Dowden, he was completely out of his depth. He wasn't.
Is this a fire manager or something?
Yeah, this was a firefighter who was watch. He was watch commander initially. Now, he is qualified to deal with fires that are known as. He's allowed a maximum of a two-pump fire, as they call it. Two-pump fire means two engines is what's needed for the response. Immediately that night, that was a six-engine fire, and it went up, I believe, at most to 20-something engines were in the area dealing with it. So from the outset, he was out of his depth. It was the first time he'd ever commanded anything like that. And what he was expected to do on his first command was throw the rule book that he was taught out the window. You know, so I don't agree with the position he took, but I can understand why he took it.
So why was there no one senior? Why was no one senior brought in quickly?
Why was there no one senior brought in quickly? Is it anything to do with the fact that, you know, there were 10,000 firefighters in this country in 2005, and I think we're barely over 5,000 now at the moment, you know? And that's why I found Boris Johnson's, Prime Minister Johnson's speech today in the Commons to be particularly insulting to us in the area and to the memories of those who died, because he's saying, you know, the authorities let them down. Well, you know, Prime Minister Johnson might be saying the authorities let us down. The problem is that it was Mayor Johnson who cut the fire service in London. And when he was questioned about that by Andrew Dismore at the London Assembly, this is online, when Andrew Dismore raised safety concerns and said, have you sort of assessed these cuts that you're planning to implement? Because it was something like 27 fire stations have been closed in London. And so that complement amount of personnel has gone as well. When Andrew Dismore asked him questions on that, he just said to him, get stuffed. That was his exact response to a member of GLA, you know, Greater London Authority representative questioning the mayor. on this issue. Get stuff.
But one would have thought...
That just speaks volumes of him.
Joe, one would have thought that firefighters who were coming back out of the building would be saying pretty quickly, and even someone observing as the fire spread up the building, round the building, that staying put was not going to be an option, one would have thought.
Well, I mean, yeah, but remember that they work within a command structure. So they are reporting back what was happening. But another issue was that the sort of communications infrastructure at the time completely fell apart. You know, there's one thing that can be done in this country in emergency situations. Obviously, in an emergency, everyone's going to be on their mobile phone. And what you can actually do as an emergency responder is you can have your calls prioritized. So basically, your phone is treated. Your phone is given priority by the local network masts compared to, you know, the average person on the street. So whilst they might be live tweeting what's happening, you know, if you need to ring the control center for something, it's your call that gets prioritized as opposed to theirs. You know, none of this infrastructure was used at the time or utilized. And this was an issue they had.
So you're saying that the commander on the ground is trying to speak to other people away from the scene to get advice?
Because the network was congested. They couldn't communicate with each other there, you know, and sort of signal back to HQ that, you know, we need this, that and the other. They said in the end they were trying to rely on email because at least they could send an email and it would sit in their outbox until they had a signal.
Amazing.
And it could be sent.
I mean, this is incredible, isn't it? In one of the biggest capitals in the world, that such as firefighters cannot communicate with the fire station. I mean, I think if you went back to the 1950s, they could do it quite easily.
Well, I mean, yeah, but you see, even back in the 1950s, there was a system that's in place for landlines. And basically, in a civil emergency, if phones are being overused, like, I don't know if you've ever tried to ring the speaking clock on New Year's Eve, just before midnight. Any other time you get put straight through to the speaking clock, that's the one time where if you ring it, it's engaged. And it's literally because there's only so many lines physically they can connect to a particular number. You know, and that's just the science of it. And it's the same with radio spectrum. You know, there's only a certain part of the radio spectrum that's used for mobile calls. And once so many phones are using that amount of spectrum, there's nothing left physically. And that's why what you need is you need a prioritization system where certain phones that are pinging the network can say, no, my call needs to be dealt with before anyone else's.
So what do you make of Commander Cotton, who has said that she doesn't think there's anything actually to learn from this?
Well, I mean, she backtracked on that last week when she was, it was last week or the week before when she spoke to the Greater London Authority. And she did say that maybe stay put needs looking at. But even there, you can still see there is this intransigence in the London Fire Service. And that's the distinction that needs to be made. The London Fire Service let people down that night. London firefighters did not. You know, they did their best. I was there that night. I saw them when they finally were able to get into that building. You know, some of them went in without breathing apparatus. Some of them went in without helmets. They just wanted to get in and try and do good. You know, there's one firefighter in particular, David Bedillo. He was the one who was basically, he risked his own life several times and against sort of operational protocol trying to find Jessica O'Bannon on the 21st or 22nd floor. You know, and I mean, they were fighting a losing battle. There was only so much an individual firefighter can do without stepping outside the control authority. And
sounds
one thing
like
that's drilled into them,
yeah,
is, you know, follow the rules, follow your orders.
Sounds like maybe something wrong with the systems by which people are put in charge. You know, I wonder whether some of the individuals who were firefighters should have been listened to more.
Well, I mean, if you look, that's why. If you look, I can't remember the chap's name, but it was like the second or third. No, it was the third or fourth person who ended up being in charge of the incident. And from the moment he came in, that's the reason why a good friend of mine's father, his name is Antonio Roncalata, he was rescued from his property at 5 a.m. You know, and it was once someone who actually was qualified to call the shots properly in these sorts of circumstances and was seasoned enough and had the training to deal with this was put in charge, you know, the operation changed. But sadly, for a lot of the victims by that point, they'd been poisoned by the toxic smoke, you know. Virtually everyone who came out of that tower was treated for cyanide poisoning.
I mean, this was caused, of course, by this flammable cladding.
Yes.
The real cause of the fire was this,
yes.
Not the failures of the fire brigade.
It's Celotex FR5000 insulation and the cladding that surrounded that.
I mean, looking at how that was put in place, it's a pretty horrific story in itself. There's a Kensington and Chelsea Conservative councillor called Rock Fielding Mellon who was intimately involved with that.
He was deputy leader of the council. Yeah, he was deputy leader of the council. And basically, he just decided that the project was overrunning. I mean, you have to remember, initially, when they said £9 million, Leadbitters, who were the favoured contractor at the time, said, we can't do it for this much. And so rather than actually looking at the project and saying, you know, are they being honest or are they just trying to inflate the prices, the council just went out and re-tendered and brought in Ryden, who said they could do it for this amount. And then when even Ryden were getting cost overruns, he went through the thing line by line and against EU procurement regulations, because all of this had been agreed in the tender that had been published. We're going to use this material for this and we're going to use that material for that. He then went through and arbitrarily changed it all himself. You know, so he was the one who changed the type of cladding.
I mean, but surely the contractors, it's actually down to them, I mean, to make sure that the regulations are enforced. It's not down to an individual councillor who's trying to cut the costs. He says, oh, we should go down to a cheaper... I mean, surely his job is to say, you know, maybe we can cut the cost on this. Surely it's the contractor's job to say, no, you can't do that. It's against regulations.
No, there was nothing against regulations about it. That's another problem. But it wasn't stuff that was advised to be used. But it wasn't that, you know, it's the way the regulations work was it was inadvisable to use this material. It was not illegal to do so.
So what's happened, you know, what's happened to Rock Fielding Mellon, who's the specific person who is behind the decision to use the flammable cladding?
Absolutely nothing. At the moment, I mean, the police have said now they're not going to prosecute until the inquiry is finished. That decision beggars belief to me. They could at least do some prosecutions. I get the big fish like Rockfield and Mellon, you might want to leave. But there are ones lower down the rung that you could get very quickly. And it would at least give people in the community some hope that, you know, things are progressing. You don't need to wait and get all of them at the end. You know, you can get some right now.
So who do you think, not necessarily naming names, but, you know, you can if you want. But who are they specifically?
If you check my Twitter feed, at Jodaphone UK on Twitter, you'll see I have two pinned tweets where I name companies that I believe are wholly responsible. Emma Dent Code, the MP for Kensington, today named individuals within those companies because she said it's unfair that firefighters have been named. When all of these company executives haven't. And so she actually spent about 5 minutes today in Parliament naming them all and their salaries and their job titles and the role that they played.
And so what were their roles? What were these companies?
Well, there were companies like Celotex, the ones who were responsible for the insulation. There was Arconic, who were responsible for the cladding and plastics. There was Ryden, the contractor. There was Harley Facades, who fitted the cladding. You know, there was Cadent, the National Grid operator. Their chap took the stand the same week that Robert Black from the TMO took the stand. Robert Black was the Thursday of that week. I think the Cadent guy was the Tuesday or Wednesday. And the Cadent guy said we couldn't cut the gas off because it was the emergency shutoff for the tower had been covered up during renovation works, and then I didn't know where any of the other shutoffs were in the area because the infrastructure map we got was inaccurate. And then when I did find a shutoff point, I didn't think it was safe to shut it off because it may have just caused a build-up on the system, which would have resulted in an overload in the gas system, and that would have caused an explosion elsewhere. I mean, this is ridiculous. You know, I'm sure you've seen videos on YouTube where people are walking along and all of a sudden a manhole cover explodes as they're just walking along the street. The reason that things like that are happening is because the infrastructure, our critical national infrastructure for gas and electricity and water, aren't treated in that way.
So, I mean, is
they're
this
commodities which are traded by hedge funds?
It seems that much of this may be linked to privatisation, Joe.
Privatisation, yes. I mean, to give you a good example of a problem with privatisation, the building research establishment. Their job is to inspect and test materials and, you know, scenarios about building safety and construction methods and things like that. They were privatized by the Blair government in 98 or 99, if memory serves. And at that point, for them, it didn't become about they weren't a safety company from that point onwards. Because this market was liberalized, as it's known, all of a sudden it wasn't about which safety company should I opt for? The question became, which safety company will give me the answer that I want? You know, the TMO's tender for a fire safety inspector for their properties actually said they wanted someone who would be a powerful voice to stand up and challenge the findings of London Fire Brigade. So in other words, you know, we think that what they're asking us for is too onerous. So we want someone who'll push back and say, no, it doesn't need to be that strict or stringent or, you know, that sort of regulated. We can deal with it more laissez-faire.
I mean,
it's the same issue that we have with the banks and the auditors, where basically the auditors don't like speaking truth unto power because the power are the ones who hold the purse strings and are paying them. And if your auditor gives you too much awkward findings every year, all you'll do is you'll get a brand new one the following year, won't you? And then they've lost the work.
And who audits the auditors?
Yeah, and that's it.
I mean, I've come across a similar thing myself, obviously not as bad as Grenfell, but where fire escapes have been metal gated up, so you can't actually get out through the fire escapes. The reason being given is that heroin addicts have been getting into certain parts of buildings where they shouldn't be, and then complaints made by residents to London Fire Brigade, and they say, well, actually, we're having to fight some legal person from the Housing Association that says actually these fire escapes must be boarded up so that they can't be used.
To all of your listeners, I would say this. You can demand a free fire inspection from your local fire authority, regardless of where you are in the country. You know, if you're London, Manchester, Yorkshire, Cornwall, Cambridge, anywhere at all, find out who your local authority. Just put in the name of your area and put in fire brigade and then home safety inspection. Everyone is entitled to one for free. If you feel that there are issues, get them now fighting with you. Because they are actually more on the ball now than they were. And you can demand a fire safety inspection for free, as I say. And if they identify defects, they issue what's known as a deficiency notice to your landlord. You know, but of course, the real problem is that we don't have legal aid anymore. That was the problem that the Grenfell Action Group faced. It was like, well, what are you going to do? That's it. Tough.
What?
And that was literally the response that we got at times when we raised concerns.
One of the biggest, I mean, I don't know how people talk about the incident, whether it's talked about more as a tragedy or an atrocity, Joe, because when you look at the flagged up warnings before the fire, saying how unsafe the buildings were and how various safety procedures and safety systems had been jerry-rigged and just not really properly done at all with pipes, for example, running up and down stairwells rather than through ducting, that sort of thing. There actually was wording along the lines, I'm paraphrasing here, saying, well, it's going to take a massive disaster with enormous loss of life, such as
that
a fire.
Francis. Yeah, that was Francis O'Connor.
For anyone to do anything.
Yeah, that was Francis O'Connor on the Grenfell Action Group blog, grenfellactiongroup.wordpress.com, and he wrote that piece in November 2016. And ironically, that was the same month that the fire service did send a deficiency notice to the TMO, which was the Kensington and Chelsea Council's arm's length, and it was arm's length in name only because K&C completely called the shots, its managing agent for the properties. You know, but you see, because we didn't have legal aid, we couldn't challenge anything that they were telling us. You know, at one point they wrote that the reason I got to know Francis and Ed behind the Grenfell Action Group blog was I'd moved on to the estate And they were threatened with libel action by the council. The council was saying, we're going to sue you for libel because of all the horrible things you're saying about us. And it was only because of my job at another council in the area. I was head of insurance and risk at a neighbouring borough. I was like, well, councils can't sue for libel. That was established in 1992, Times Newspapers versus Derbyshire County Council. So they can't threaten you with libel. And when I went back and pushed back, all they then said was, well, we're going to fund individual council officers to sue you for libel because you're saying horrible things about them. You know, and that's totally illegal for them to do as well. They cannot use council public funds in that manner. What about the tax implications of doing that? What happens if they lose? You know, who's going to pay the costs? So you're going to cover the costs as well. You don't have that authority as a council to use public money in that fashion.
It sounds like a landlord that's creating a hostile environment for tenants.
Oh, it's not that. It's a public authority that just seems to. It's more. They feel they're more about the authority than they are about the public part. You know, they forget they're public servants. That's it. And you know, we're not. They're not there to serve us. We're there to be managed. You know, and that's why it's ironic. It was the tenant management organisation. It wasn't a housing management organisation. It was a tenant management organisation. I think subconsciously, when that was set up, and its first registered address, by the way, was Kensington and Chelsea Town Hall, Haughton Street, WA. You can look at that on Companies House. You see, whoever set that up subconsciously knew what they were planning from the outset.
Well, there's been a big pushback here in Bristol against TMOs for probably something like 10, 15 years now, mm-hmm. because people who've been working in housing professionally have made sure they didn't happen and that they campaigned very strongly against them, seeing them as a sort of Trojan horse, really, in order to part privatise in a way that local authorities would find acceptable. But look, you've mentioned a few times this whole thing of legal aid. That does sound like, I mean, that all changed with the coalition government, Ken Clark, getting rid of that. So how has that affected people? You know, not just yourself, Joe.
I mean, that was LESPO, I believe it's called, the Legal Aid Sentencing Powers or something like that Act. LASPO, I'm sure it was the acronym for it. That's caused so much injustice. Because, you know, what little chance you had of holding these people to account is now gone, unless you sort of, you know, you have unlimited wealth.
Yeah, but you've got the public inquiry that you wanted.
We've got the public inquiry we wanted, I have to say. Sir Martin Morbick, you know what, I kind of owe him a slight apology in some ways, because, you know, I wasn't being deliberately harsh on him just for the sake of malice. I wanted to keep him on his toes because I wanted him to do the right thing. And I have to say that in this, in the phase one report, broadly speaking, that's what's happened. I mean, the fact that he's, if you read the entire report, it is absolutely damning. And it's just unfortunate that the Telegraph were the ones who had the first leak of the report. And so they were the ones who framed the argument.
Well, that's interesting because they're sympathetic to the Conservative Party, aren't they?
Yes. Oh, not just sympathetic to the Conservative Party. Don't forget, Mr. Johnson is on their payroll. You know, they give him £250,000 of chicken feed a year for writing the occasional article for them. So it's awfully coincidental that they were the ones who got the copy, first of all. And clearly they got that copy quite early in the day for them to have put that out that evening. So my theory is that the only people who got that report besides us core participants, we were given physical paper copies, by the way. I understand that Downing Street was given the digital version. And the fact that the Telegraph had a copy so quickly would lead me to indicate that it was a digital copy they had. And there was only one of those available, and it was at Downing Street. So I'm firmly of the opinion that it was Downing Street that leaked it because they want it. And the fact that the Telegraph framed it as firefighters are to blame just, you know, reinforces that belief of mine.
But I mean, the inquiry hasn't...
firefighters blamed? It's Boris Johnson.
The inquiry hasn't finished yet. What are we going to be seeing in the coming weeks and months?
I think given the way that Morbick has dealt with phase one, I think we're going to see some very interesting things coming out in phase two. I have a lot more confidence in Sir Martin Morbick now than I did on the day he was appointed when I first met him.
But we've seen also that there are other buildings with this same cladding still on them, Joe.
Yes, there are. And now that issue there is absolutely disgraceful. I'm sorry, if you're someone who built a block and you have sold flats within that block. In any other country, I mean, look, they're saying that they didn't know that this stuff was defective, you know, and they were just relying on safety tests, which is fair enough. But what that would be then considered in legal terms, and this is me speaking with my insurance hat on again, it's what's known as a latent defect. And a latent defect is one that you could not reasonably have known about unless you sort of tested something to absolute destruction, which would be seen as unreasonable. That's fair enough. But in most other common law countries, the if a latent defect is identified, liability lies with the seller. In Britain, it relies on the buyer under the principle of caveat emptor. That desperately needs to change. You know, it's only when these people are threatened in the pocket. If they're threatened in the pocket or with prison, that's when you'll get them on side. You know, and that's what we need to do. Corporate manslaughter doesn't work in this country. There's not been a company that's got, say, more than 50 employees or 100 employees that has ever had a successful corporate manslaughter charge against it. And the reason is the threshold of corporate manslaughter is you have to show a controlling mind. And you're not going to do that in a big multinational multi-billion dollar a year company. There's not someone sitting in some executive office on the top floor somewhere twirling their moustache as they, you know, make these evil decisions and laughing maniacally. It's a succession of decisions that are taken that lead to these issues, you know, and that's why that threshold is ridiculous. So what you should do is either we have a named officer, either we can hang them all together, or there is one that can be identified who can be hanged separately. Because then, believe me, they will make damn sure that things comply. A story I always rely on is the Chinese government with the Millennium Bug. There was concerns about, you know, planes falling out of the sky and everything. So the Chinese government passed a law, and it said that all airplane executives had to be in the air at midnight. You see, and so all of a sudden, they had a damn good incentive to make sure that their planes were safe and would comply and wouldn't have any issues, regardless of what may happen on the ground.
And I suppose,
you know, and I think that's what we need. We need that moral hazard reintroduced into corporate business. Because at the moment, you know, to quote the great literary piece that is Shrek, the first film, as the Lord guy in that says when he's sending the knights off on a dangerous quest, he's like, yes, it's dangerous and some of you may die, but that is a risk I'm willing to take. You know, and that's it. And that's the situation we're in now. It's absolutely farcical.
So the fact is that we have flammable cladding on buildings. This can happen again, potentially.
Yes, it can. It can indeed. Absolutely. Absolutely, 100%. It will happen again. Look, we were lucky. It happened. We were lucky that nothing happened in Barking at the fire very recently. We were lucky that it didn't happen at the other one that's occurred since Grenfell. And the reason it's happened since then is that people are sort of on their toes. And thankfully, no one is listening to stay put advice anymore. And they're getting the hell out the moment there is the remotest suspicion of anything going wrong. You know, it's certainly they're not getting out now because the instructions have changed. And, you know, the instructions aren't going to change until people are found liable. And so we're in this ridiculous situation now where they feel that, oh, we can't change things because, you know, that might be seen as an admission of liability.
I mean, it seems to me also that you've got the justice of this. In other words, people paying the price, going to jail, etc., for causing this fire, for willfully ignoring warnings, that sort of thing, who were supposed to be responsible, who were happy to take the money to do their jobs. But then when it came to the actual responsibility of the job, they looked the other way. That does not look as if it's still not really happening yet, Joe. And it might be long way down the line, mightn't it?
It's not. It's not. But that's why I said, you see, we need to say this in the way that, you know, there are more. I mean, look, if you run a charity, within your charity, you have to name someone as finance officer. And that person can be held personally liable for any losses that charity incurs. You know, and so that's why charity finance offices make damn sure that there's nothing iffy in the account, because, you know, it's their personal assets that will be at stake. This is what we need. We need in corporate, we need in our world of business and trade, we need these people to have some real skin in the game, because if they don't, then, you know, that's it. Some of you may get hurt, but it's a risk I'm willing to take.
Okay, Joe Delaney, thanks very much for joining us.
You're most welcome. Take care.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name's Roma Widger. I'm a Bristol resident. I've lived here for the past 30-odd years, and I'm increasingly concerned about housing in this city and beyond. And I think we've got two kinds of housing problem. One is homelessness, but probably more pertinent is the cost of housing and the fact that it is crippling our economy.
Everyone needs somewhere to live, Roma, but so how come so few people get involved in campaigning around housing? Is it something that we all have to have and live with? But most people have got a beef of some sort about either their own home or their situation, whether, you know, having to rent, that sort of thing.
There's very few people who will be prepared to speak up and less people prepared to listen, because there's a minority of people that are making a lot of money from other people suffering in housing. In fact, landlords tend to own multiple properties. It's quite different if you're a landlord and you're letting, for example, to a huge number of ex-council houses. You don't like people to talk about the price of property then. If you're selling, or even if you're a constructor and you're thinking of building projects, there's a lot of money to be made, and nobody likes to think that they might be underdone out of a few bob.
Well, we've seen, I mean, the sort of old ex-council houses you're talking about, we've also seen on the old brewery site in the city centre, an enormous building project, Finsel's Reach, yeah. And I was walking past there, maybe, of course, must be 18 months ago, and someone actually came and, virtually grabbed me from the housing marketing suite. Said, "Oh, are you looking for a place around here?" And I thought, well, I sort of went along with it. And they are really aggressively marketing these places. We're talking about £300,000-£400,000 for a flat, small flat, actually. And they're in the situation there where they've built something like three quarters of the flats. They may have sold more now, but they don't actually finish building these projects until they've actually sold the existing flat. So they can be building a project like Finsel's Reach for something like 7-8 years. They don't. The idea of actually finishing it and then selling the flats has gone out the window, probably into the water. But they have a whole load of flats they've got planning permission for, but they don't actually build them because they haven't sold the ones they've already built.
It's part of a policy of drip feeding houses into the market. In March 2017, there were 2,069 dwellings under construction, but 5,209...
That's here in Bristol.
Yeah. 5,290 dwellings had actually got permission to be built, with a further 1,092 subject to consent.
This is what they call the pipeline in the building industry. Well, we must have a pipeline of new properties coming on the market. That's where also, if you go further back down the pipeline, land banking. So they want to buy the land to just invest as a speculator in the land, that once they've finished selling the other houses they've got existing planning permission for, then they've got a whole load of... But actually what you end up with is house builders who aren't actually... Well, they are building houses, but a lot of the houses haven't actually been built. They're really more like speculators investing in the potential in the future at some point to build a house. So why are we here? Why? How did we get to this stage where a house builder is not actually interested in building all the houses they can? They'd rather keep a lot of them back and only drip feed them through.
A lot of it is the financial system. What this does is to limit the amount of houses coming onto the market, and in keeping them scarce, so there's never quite enough houses, it keeps the price high. That is a technique. That isn't quite like building houses and making
a profit.
That's
naughty, isn't it? Because in a way, if they were to build the houses they could, they'd become more affordable for the rest of us.
Yeah, let's call that immoral, not naughty. And furthermore, 20% is the amount that really construction projects should make, according to the government. It's obvious that a lot of constructors are not telling the truth. In fact, they're making a lot more than 20%, but part of that is just holding back drip feeding.
What about the cost to build versus the cost to buy? This is something that always amazes me. If you actually look at what it costs to build a house, you can be talking about paying three or four times more than that to buy it. Why is that?
It's the land. The land is the most expensive part of your house. Now, one of the things that has hit Bristol is there is a target that everybody should be within 25 minutes walk or 15 minutes cycle of the centre of town. Now, why would we want this? Because not everybody works in the centre of town.
But is that because the first bus is so appalling and then no one wants to get the bus?
No, I think the idea is we should be carbon free. But you see, there is a large amount of land. We don't need to keep building up in tower blocks. There are amounts of land, and I'm not really talking brownfield sites, but as you go out towards the airport, for example, some of that land there beyond Cumberland Basin, that could be built on. It's not. Lots of places on the outskirts, little plots of land which might reasonably be developed are not being
developed.
So
you don't believe in the Green Belt then?
I do believe in the Green Belt, but there's little spaces which would suitably be developed and they're not being so. Sometimes they're owned and just being kept. Reserved for what? Other times, it just keeps the price of land very high because there's not enough of it.
And the price of housing is so high as well. So this is actually getting prohibitive in Bristol. It's a very popular place to live for all sorts of reasons, but it means that there are quite an increasing numbers of people that really have given up all hope of buying a house. And maybe some of those might include teachers for even.
Yeah, teachers, nurses, bus drivers, public servants, people who are working for us, for the good of the community. Those are the kind of people that are being priced out of the house market. Now, the price of houses is relatively immaterial. Lots of people now think they would buy a house. Maybe they never expect to live in it for their whole life. And perhaps the mortgage is quite a lot. What is actually clobbering people is the price of the deposit. On average now, a house owner would be 40 and would probably need £20,000 minimum as a deposit. That is so wrong.
Well, in my parents' generation, we're talking about the 50s here, the early 60s, they were buying a house literally when they got married. I mean, we're talking about 20, 21, 22 years old.
Yes.
Not 40.
Yes. Now, I got a house when I got married because I was in a deposit help plan. And that was something that was tried out in the north because in one of the last recessions, there was a shortage of money, there was a shortage of work, there was a shortage of everything. And in York, they had a plan to get the community going again.
And so what was this, a local authority doing this, central government? Who was up behind it?
Well, it was a local authority because they realised that they needed to do something and they gave a limited number of assisted deposits and one of them was mine. Otherwise, I wouldn't be a house owner today.
Amazing. So how does that compare with George Osborne's wonderful Help to Buy scheme, which I've heard house builders talking under their breath, saying actually it's a Help to Sell scheme. But the Help to Buy scheme is supposed to encourage young people to get their foot on the ladder, a housing ladder.
Well, all these things are helpful, but not everybody is young. Not everybody is a first time.
How does it compare to your scheme?
Well, with my
in York.
Well, the scheme in York meant that you had to live in the city, you had to be a first-time buyer, you had to work in the city, you had to have a prospect of paying the mortgage. That was all. But you didn't have to save £20,000 before you began. Now, the buying the house scheme of George Osborne, it's a similar thing, but it's not generalised enough. Why is it that we're seeing nurses, bus drivers, teachers, government workers, they can't get on the house to buy scheme. They can't get the deposit together. Therefore, they're renting. The renting market is very limited because there's hardly any properties left to rent.
There's something so wrong here because people are often paying more in rent than they would be if they were paying a mortgage.
It's totally wrong. It's partly wrong because you get people actually mouthing the words, "That house is my pension scheme." What? I mean, that is living off somebody else's housing misery.
So people who own these houses, landlords, are looking at the people in those houses, the renters, as paying their pensions off.
They are cash cows.
Maybe they're concerned that the estate pension is not going to be enough and that they're worried about their retirement. Why shouldn't they be?
Well, I expect they are worried, but, I mean, we wouldn't take the food out of people's mouths and go, oh, well, that helps my pension.
Well, maybe not. Well, some people might. I don't want to be too cynical, but some people might. Also, this means that, I mean, for many people, if they do want to buy their own home, they might be forced out of the city.
Yes. Who are the losers then? Us. Because the people forced out of the city won't be the people who are helping our communities. They'll be the people that are involved in big business that can afford to stay.
So they'll be looking at places in Wales, maybe, up north, up, you know, sort of Midlands area. Where do you think most, you know, where's the obvious place to look?
Probably the north. If you go to the North Midlands and probably somewhere like Derbyshire, Nottinghamshire, the houses are much, much cheaper and life is very different there. In Nottingham, a huge percentage of people living there rent. And if you buy, you can get a 3-bedroom property with a big garden for something like £130,000.
Why is Bristol so expensive then?
Because the houses are scarce, the land is expensive, and it's just a very limited market.
Well, there are a few cities in the country, aren't there, that are like this, that are sort of at ridiculous house prices. Oxford's another place. It's almost impossible to get anywhere to live in Oxford. Why do you think that is?
Because more people want to live there than there are houses, and that just pushes the price up. If you go to somewhere, perhaps where there's a much less lucrative working environment, the houses are less. People don't want to be there.
Pretty simple. For a lot of people, they will decide, well, actually, I've had enough of this renting malarkey. Mm. We've got a big population living in caravans. In fact, there was an article on 25th of September this year, 2019, about van dwellers. It talked about two particularly, one called Becky, who's 36 years old, one guy called Mark, who's 37. Becky was paying £600 a month, which is pretty cheap in one place. Mark paying £900 a month for a one-bedroom flat. So this is a lot of money to find every month, £12,000 a year almost on your rent is a lot of money to find. And both of them now say that their costs are below £250 a month. They're living in vans.
Yeah.
Is that normal now, do you think?
I think it probably is normal. It goes
for young people particularly, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, young people are paying extortionate rents because they can't get the deposit to buy the house.
And they see it as throwing good money after bad.
It is.
Week after week after week.
It is. It's putting money in somebody else's pocket. Now, there's another way of looking at this, I suppose you'd call it mobile living. In Amsterdam after the war, there was a desperate shortage of housing and many people lived on boats. So it was accepted that there would be a kind of temporary stroke permanent accommodation solution. I think the van thing is the equivalent really in Bristol, because we're saying this isn't permanent, this isn't forever, but this is good for you now. What worries me is that there is increasingly an attitude that says, well, you're very lucky to have it. You know, you've got somewhere to live and that should be good enough. But what is good enough? Because the only kind of good enough there should be is, would I live there? Would I be prepared to live in a van? And actually, I don't think many people want to live in a van.
Well, this article in the I paper with Becky and Mark, it makes it look rather nice. They've got some lovely shots in there. Another thing is they come up with a statistic of around 22,500 people living in vehicles and caravans in Britain. And this is not mobile homes. This is, you know, basically a caravan parked by the side of the road, which is roughly, 35,000 people living like this now.
Yeah, and these people are not Romanies. They're not gypsies. They're people that live in there, you know, van dwellers. One of the problems with it is I think aggression from other people in the environment. Where I live, because I live in St Andrews, and a few years ago there were a number of van dwellers that came to live in the vicinity of where I live. And that was great, 3, 4, 5. And then it was noticed that there were a lot of van dwellers. And then people started to mutter about hygiene and sewage. And in no time at all, they were all dispatched.
So the council has to provide sites like this. The only thing is that the only site they do provide is out in Avonmouth.
Well, you can't get to work from Avonmouth unless you've got your own transport.
I mean, maybe the council should be thinking about their own policy to do with being able to walk to work and find some sites a bit closer. In fact, I can think of 3 or 4 without even trying, which are derelict land of some sort, which is waiting to be developed, owned by property speculators, very, very close to the city centre, where people could live reasonably happily. I think there's, you know, there's also, I suppose, an attitude by some at the council where we don't want that sort of thing to be seen to be going on in Bristol. You know, collections of travellers living close to the city centre.
Yeah, but you see, what it is, most people don't want the equivalent of a refugee camp at the end of their road, but maybe the equivalent of a close of houses. I mean, if you're talking perhaps of 5, 8, 10 vans, but people don't want to see 50 at the end of their road because they feel overwhelmed.
Well, the council, are they doing anything about this? Are they thinking about the idea of maybe...
No, because some people are making so much money from the housing market as it is, whether they're renting or selling. Nobody who is making money wants to see it resolved. And people who are trying to help people who need homes tend to focus on the basic, saying things like, well, this will do. This will do wouldn't suit most of us. So why would it suit people who are in a desperate situation?
Well, it just seems maybe that they're not getting any council tax from these people, so they don't care about them, maybe. Well, look, also, back in the 1960s, 70s, people were buying houses for 2.5 times their annual salary. So that's changed, you know, enormously now. We're talking about 7, 8, 9 times their annual salary to buy a house. Why such an enormous change over the years?
One of the problems is that people had council houses as an alternative to buying. So in the 60s and 70s, you could probably expect, certainly if you were on the waiting list, that you could have a rented home, probably with Parker Morris standards. Now, those standards were put in 1961, and it was to give people a basic standard of living, and every council house adhered not just to those standards, but sometimes to something slightly better. So it wasn't a case of you had to buy. Now, after 1980, when the Conservative government sold off the council...
So these standards, what did you call Parker?
Well, they're the Parker-Morris standards.
Morris standards. That was about size of house, kind of what facilities you've got, what rooms you've got in there, toilet size, bathroom size, all that sort of thing.
Yes, so for example, you had to have an indoor flushing toilet if you had 1 or 2 bedrooms, and you had to have a certain amount of square feet per person. Now, if your dwelling exceeded 6 people, you had to have an extra 10 cubic feet of dwelling space as communal space.
You know what this is making me think of is those modern student flats that are going up all over the city. Nothing like that sort of standard. In fact, you're talking about almost all your personal space is going to be your bedroom, with a tiny little space for a kitchenette at the end, maybe 7, 8 students in individual rooms. All they've got is a communal, I think they have their own little bathroom in their own flat normally, but a kitchenette and a sitting area and a TV and not even a dining table.
I think you're being a bit generous there, Tony. You're talking about bathrooms. Most of them have got pods, not bathrooms. So in effect, you're standing on the shower floor when you go to the loo. You've got a wash basin that is probably above the shower floor, and the whole thing is probably not much bigger than a yard square. God, that is not a bathroom.
No, it's not really. Okay. It's a bit like Kowloon standards, which were like notoriously cramming the most people into the smallest space possible. We're going down that road in Bristol now. What happens If there aren't enough students to fill these places, I suppose that they're going to be rented out to people like you and me.
They are. And I think that a lot of building has been done under the cover of student housing. They're not intended to house students long term. What they will in fact do is to find that there are no students who want to rent them eventually, because when they're nice and new and glossy, you can probably get the students to live in them. When in fact there's a few more developers that have come along and they're not so nice and new and glossy, people will be much less inclined to pay the rents, because most of them are in excess of £100 a week for something which is really no bigger than a cupboard.
These students should be in vans, I think. But anyway.
I don't think so. There's too many of them.
I mean, you could, maybe one or two more adventurous students. But look, I mean, you yourself are a homeowner.
Yes.
But you can see the advantage of social housing, of council housing. Which route do you think's preferable?
I think council housing is the route. I can't justify in my own mind why it was ever sold off. In fact, a lot of what was sold off is now in private hands, private landlords, people coining it.
But you wanted to buy your own home, didn't you?
I did.
Just like a lot of those people who were in council houses, who Margaret Thatcher gave the chance to buy them.
There's always going to be a big rental market for a variety of complex reasons. Families have changed hugely. Split families, merged families, different families. Sometimes people that are travelling round, not living near where they work, that kind of thing. And there should always be the ability to rent. But actually, if people had an assisted deposit, they could probably buy. And people say, oh, it would cost so much to... But nobody's saying give people money to buy a house. Nobody's saying let them off the price. But in real terms, 20,000 and more for a deposit, and to spend so long saving when you're paying so much rent, it's not going to happen for a lot of people.
So in a nutshell, what do you think needs to be done? Well, how can we change all this? Because it all seems to be heading in the wrong direction. There's the possibility of a reset, which is a collapse in the property prices back down to what they should be. I mean, we talk about the difference between the cost to build and cost to buy. It may be houses actually costing to buy the same roughly as they would cost to build. So, you know, this equivalent across the country, how much it costs in terms of materials and hours of labour to build a house, which is in here in Bristol, we're probably talking about a quarter of the price you're paying for it. How are we going to change it all, Roma?
We're going to change it by cutting down on some of the wasteful projects like railway lines to go to the north to save you 50 minutes in your journey to London.
Yeah.
And instead of that, to use some of that money to ease people into the housing market. Because if deposits were less, there could be more buyers. If there were more buyers, it would take the pressure off the rental market. If there were more buyers, it would jiggle up the construction industry. People would have a more stable
way of
living.
But what you're saying wouldn't reduce the price of housing. It would still be, you know, far too high, surely.
No, we're desperate for houses in this country. And in fact, there's got to be something like 4 million houses constructed to meet the need by the year 2040.
What's that going to do to the housing industry then? Because they won't like it if everyone's got a house. They've got nothing to do.
Well, they'll be building houses, and the want for houses won't go away, because most people do aspire to have their own home. Very few people want to live with their mum and dad forever. And you've only got to look at the number of children at school with the number of houses in their area, and it gives you an idea of how much housing is actually needed.
It sounds like a pressure cooker that's about to go bang maybe at some point. But I mean, does what we do in Britain here compare to other countries? You know, this whole idea of buying a place, or maybe buying several places, having people paying rent and seeing the property that you own as a massive asset which is accumulating all the time that you can do something with in your retirement, for example.
Different countries operate in separate systems. In Japan, for example, your house is practically worthless. When you die, it will probably be demolished. The Japanese government regularly give or entice single people to take on these houses. They're not built to last forever and you only ever expect your house to be for you is quite different to the way we live here, where your house is seen as the biggest investment you'll ever ever make.
Well, I mean, I quite like the idea that someone might have a house which is from the 1500s, you know, from a long, long time ago, and a beautiful old stone cottage, or, you know, maybe even something a bit bigger. Yeah. But surely that's the norm. You know, the idea is that houses are supposed to last. You don't destroy them when you die.
Yeah, I mean, culturally, we do take the attitude that you've just expressed. But, for example, there's nothing wrong with improving. We don't all have to live, for example, in a shack that was never really fit for purpose. I mean, houses can improve. We should be able to adapt, to add to them, to, you know, to appreciate them for long periods of time.
I think the other thing is that quite a lot of people, particularly in the rented market, are constantly nervous about not being able to pay that month's rent and worried about eviction. And this is actually quite a source of almost unconscious angst. You know, it's like, oh no, you know, I must do exactly what I'm supposed to do this month. I've got to not think anything negative about my boss, otherwise I might not get a salary at the end of the month and I might be out of my ear. So there's this constant fear of eviction in the back of a lot of millions of people's minds.
Yeah, and one of the reasons for this is a shortage of rental property. I mean, at the moment, as you say, it's like a pressure cooker. There are loads of people who would like to buy, they're renting, they can't manage to save the deposit. They just plod on. And, of course, rental property is very scarce. If it was less scarce, landlords would have a bit less of a stranglehold. So instead, for example, of charging massive deposits, because even if you want to rent a property, and we just spoke about somebody who's paying £900 a month.
For a one-bedroom flat. Yeah.
For a one-bedroom flat. I mean, even somebody like that would need to pay probably £1,800 up front. Who's got that money? Probably, if you are somebody who's just got a job, you've been a student, you've done all the things that students do, like run up a student loan and maybe a bit of an overdraft and things, £1,800 to put down as a deposit, which you're then going to have to fight for when you leave your property, is not really good. So, and I think it would take the pressure off of the rental market.
So, I mean, any of the political parties, I mean, we're talking about all of them here, thinking about these things, because we don't hear a lot. I mean, you would have thought that this was something that the Labour Party would really be pushing. But are any of the political parties taking this seriously?
No. One of the reasons is so many politicians are posh boys, and lots of people just do not realise what it is like to be an ordinary person. I don't think any of the political parties are addressing the issue of housing. I don't think they're even thinking about it. And I think that they're afraid of losing votes, because people in all the parties, there is a proportion of people that are making a big income from the shortage of property. We need more property. We need assisted deposits. We need a long-term plan. And it would just release the pressure from that pressure cooker.
Well, you know what, Roma? I'm going to ask you to keep an eye on this subject and maybe come back and talk to us in the run-up to the mayor election in May 2020. We're going to decide on a all-powerful super lord. Well, it's not the Lord Mayor, it's the mayor. It's now Marvin Rees. It might not be next year. And in that political campaign, I think we need to make sure that this housing issue is taken a bit more seriously.
Well, do you know what? I think if anybody went to be mayor who said that housing was their priority, it would be such an asset, because unless we get to grips with housing, education, the NHS, lots of other things are going to struggle for employees. We're going to struggle to keep up our standards. All the time, everything relates back to housing.
And you know what? It's also the thing we spend most of our money on in our entire lives, generally, is housing. Second might be a car. Unless you're one of the super rich playboys or playgirls, then you've got far too much money than you even know what to do with. But housing takes up an enormous amount of our cash.
Well, just recently, there was a survey which was prescribing how much of your salary in an ideal world should go on necessaries. Things like your council tax, your rent or your mortgage, your basic bills. in an ideal world, that should only be 50% of your earnings. There should be another percentage which was for pleasure or quality of life. And then there should be a certain amount which was for savings.
I think we used to call it disposable income, didn't we? The
we
money
did.
That you're left with at the end of the month once you've paid all the bills.
That's it. So only 50% should be on your expenses. 50% should be disposable income. But of course, who's saving 10 or 20% of their income? Not many people.
In fact, we had the former Governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, who, by the way, he is the son of a railway porter who went to grammar school in Worcester. He's not one of the elite. And he was saying that Britain has got the worst record of savings right now of any country in the G20. We're not saving money in Britain anymore.
That's not surprising, really, because when you look at how much disposable income you've got, for most people, it's not an awful lot. There are a lot of people on fixed incomes, and for a lot of people, it will be a dream that only 50% of their salary went on the necessaries.
Now, if I was thinking about giving you a mortgage, Roma, and you were on a 0 hours contract, I'd take one look at that and say, well, you can't guarantee you're going to pay the mortgage, so sorry.
Oh, don't get me started, Tony. 0 hours contracts ought to be out the window, as should be limited employment contracts. Lots of people now, when they go for a job, they only get perhaps 2 years, a contract for 2 years, or maybe slightly longer, maybe 3 years. You can't get any sort of agreement on that. You couldn't have a mortgage, you couldn't buy a car. That kind of thing should be illegal.
We've been sold short, haven't we?
We've been sold short a lot.
Let's try and make sure we've got a mayor next time that understands a little bit of this and can make a real difference to the lives of people in Bristol. Roma, would you? Thanks very much, and I'm sure it won't be the last time. Thanks.
Thanks, Tony.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone, in the car, or anywhere you like. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Joe Delaney from the Grenfell Action Group, and to Roma Widger, BCFM's housing expert, also to studio engineer Dave Pazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk or on the phone at 0117 909 6897. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the national volunteering website do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my 2-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now. It's all a matter of time. I will not worry for you, you'll be just fine. Take my thoughts with you, and when you look behind, you will surely see a face that you recognize. Wait till the end of time. Open your mind. Surely it's plain to see. You're not alone. I'll wait till the end of time for you. Open your mind. Surely there's time to be with me.